and it's like a ghost town. Baby, where did he be at when they said they're doing all this?
David Cobb is a reporter. He's a writer for CBS Sports, covering college basketball, college football for them. You can find him on Twitter at David W. Cobb. He joins me now. David, how are you, man? How you doing?
I'm good. Just ready to get off some hot takes. You know me.
Yeah, I got you. I mean, you're basically, you do like a daily spot on one of the shows every single day here, 5 days a week. Brad might not be happy with me bringing this up. Do we maybe a paid spot? Maybe we need to get some money involved here soon.
Hey, have your people talk to my people. I'm
all
down.
Right. Who are your people?
Me mainly.
Okay.
Me. I'm my people. Yeah.
Gotcha. We have heard from DeAndre Williams' people. Holler me about DeAndre Williams. What do you think about this situation, man?
I mean, it's crazy on the surface, but if you go and look at it, the man has only played 4 seasons of college basketball, and one of them was the COVID year. So, yeah, on the surface, it's absurd that a 27-year-old would be playing college basketball next season, but unless there's something that I'm not aware of with, like, you know, the NCAA clock, and you got however many years to play however many seasons, right? Like, he should be able to actually play next season. And it makes a ton of sense. Like, I know there's a faction of Memphis fans that are probably over him, but believe me, when you go in depth on the status of this Memphis basketball roster right now, like, you should be excited about DeAndre Williams coming back.
I don't think it's legitimate fans that should be saying move on. Like, you should, telling him to move on would be insane considering what he's meant to this program the last 3 years. I mean, 17-8 last year, first team all conference. If he comes back next year in that conference, I mean, we're talking about a top 3 player. I mean, potentially conference player of the year if he comes back next year with the new look conference.
Yeah, absolutely. And they just need talent. Like, I think what we're looking at, if DeAndre Williams comes back, I know they don't necessarily have a rim protector in the fold right now. Like, that's a little bit of a question mark, that 5 spot, and especially if Malcolm's not going to come back. Not that he's some elite shot blocker anyway. So that's my question. But on the whole, they look like a really good defensive team.
Yep.
That's kind of how I see them shaking up if you get DeAndre Williams back, because Leonard comes in from MTSU. He's a high-level defender. You're going to have a lot of length and a lot of size kind of on the perimeter, a lot of switchability, 2 through 4. Maybe DeAndre plays the 5. Maybe that ends up happening. And so I see it being a team that's better defensively, more like the middle 3 Penny teams were, because, like, his first team wasn't great defensively, and this past year they took a step back defensively. But those teams in the middle were really good defensively. Mm-hmm. And I can see this team, you know, being that again next season. Offensively, I'm not totally sold, right, that they've made the replacements necessary to kind of get over that hump of losing Kendrick Davis. But that was always going to be a tall ask. So if you get DeAndre back and you get Mikey Williams in, like, I start to feel a little bit better about where Memphis basketball is headed.
Now, I know this will surprise you, but I got smacked down a little bit. I heard from a lot of people via Twitter about my DeAndre Williams take when I went live reacting to it yesterday. I know that'll surprise you. I know that surprised you.
What was your take?
But the word I used here was desperation. And I explained this earlier. Desperation's not necessarily a bad thing always. Desperation sometimes breeds some people's best work, right? And if desperation is meaning you want to get back to the NCAA tournament, you want to be a championship-caliber team, then that's good desperation. And I think going after and trying to get DeAndre Williams, that shows a level of desperation. But I don't think this is exclusive by any stretch of the imagination to Penny Hardaway. There's a bunch of coaches around the country who have to get desperate at this time of year. I look at John Calipari. I look at Juwan Howard. I look at other people that have to be desperate in trying to find proven commodities, proven talent to bring into their teams on their rosters by next year.
Yeah, part of the reason I would assume that Penny is interested in this, that DeAndre Williams is pursuing this, is because Memphis has realized that the remnants of the transfer portal are scarce and drying up at a rapid pace. There's just not a lot out there in terms of high quality, high major rotation players left. I mean, there's very few of my top 50 I think there's four or five left uncommitted, a couple of those being grad transfers who have been able to enter late. So it's like you say, Kentucky, they're in a world of trouble after not only Oscar, like Oscar stayed in the draft, that was a little bit of a surprise, but also Chris Livingston decides to stay in the draft as well. Now Kentucky is entering June with several open scholarships and a roster comprised at this time almost entirely of freshmen and inexperienced players. So you're right, there are several teams around the country in a tough position. And it's not as if there's a bunch of Amani Bates, Jalen Duren type of players waiting to reclass at the end of this cycle. Like, we might see one or two more, right? Like, you always get that late July, early August, last minute, got my high school credits in order, you know, decision from a player or two. But by and large, those guys don't end up being all that impactful anyway because they're so young. It really is desperate times for college basketball coaches out there looking for talent. And I don't blame – I think it would be wonderful for Memphis if they got an experienced player like DeAndre Williams back on the roster.
I see a couple of other guys out there that could potentially be part of the fold. Olivier Kamwa, I mean, what do you think ultimately happens with him? He took his name out of the NBA draft circles. David Jones is a guy who was on campus as well. I mean, it looks like this roster could be filled out relatively well, regardless of if DeAndre Williams puts his name back in the fold or not. I still think there's always some type of trick up Penny Hardaway's sleeve. And this, by the way, takes the cake. The DeAndre Williams extra year of eligibility takes the cake for tricks up the sleeve.
Yeah, absolutely. No, the David Jones one would be interesting. I don't have him ranked, but he's a wing who can score, which I think is something that would be of interest to Memphis at this point. Like I said, don't really see, especially if DeAndre doesn't show up or doesn't come back, right? Like, I don't see a ton of offensive hierarchy. Like this time last year, you could look at the Memphis basketball roster and see exactly how it was going to work. And they even ended up relying on Kendrick and DeAndre more than I thought they would, but it worked fine. They were the best offensive team of the Penny Hardaway era. Like right now, I don't think anyone has any idea, regardless of who ends up playing on this team next year, who's going to be the guy offensively, what that hierarchy is going to look like. They just need more scorers, more options offensively, I think. So a guy like a David Jones would help. Kamwa is interesting. Obviously, I watched a lot of him at Tennessee. Ton of talent. He just struggled to really put it all together. But I could see him being an interesting fit at Memphis because he comes from a defensive-oriented culture at Tennessee. Mm-hmm. He can step out and shoot the three. You play him and DeAndre together at the four and the five, that could actually be pretty interesting. Like, I don't know what his appetite is for Memphis, but like I would like him at Memphis. I think that could really work.
Talking with David Cobb, CBS Sports at David W. Cobb on Twitter. Zach Edey, who's a Naismith, he was the player of the year. He comes back to Purdue, and I think like there's been a lot of negative NIL conversations, right? About like especially SEC spring meetings going on this week, and we'll get to that in a second. But there's a lot of negative NIL conversations. But do you view NIL, especially in college basketball, do you think it's made the overall product better? Because I think I'm sort of on board with that line of thinking.
Yeah, I kind of do. I mean, you're getting players back who you normally wouldn't. I mean, I just saw the official NBA communications list of players who withdrew after going through the pre-draft process. It's over 100 players. I think it's great. None of this was happening 5 years ago. I mean, 5, 6 years ago, you weren't allowed to explore or test the waters like you can now. It was either you're coming out or you're staying in. You had to make that decision with very little information. You could have your NCAA eligibility revoked for even meeting with an agent or having a discussion with a professional franchise. Now you're able to do that. You're able to enter a position of leverage between an NIL collective and the professional organizations that your agent is talking to, and you're able to make an informed decision. And I'm not saying that every guy always makes the right decision, but at least you have the chance to. I mean, before, like I said, you could get in trouble just for talking to an agent who might actually have the information that you needed, right? So what are you going to do? Go and Google search your name or search your name on Twitter to figure out what your draft stock is? I mean, in all reality, it's so much better now than it was before, and I don't think there's any losers in that process. I mean, the only And no one's going to feel sorry for the college coaches who make seven figures here, but they're the only ones who really have anything to complain about because their stress levels are through the roof now into the summer months. Because, like, look at what Penny's having to deal with right now. Instead of playing golf, like maybe he could have 6 or 7 years ago at this time of year, he's got to be stressing out about, you know, his roster. And that's, by and large, every coach around the country having to sweat it out through that draft deadline day. And then still work the portal after that. So, I mean, really, they're the only ones who have anything.
I think NIL is good because you bring back good personalities and good players that are more entertaining that you get to watch on national TV more often. I'm not speaking to the team building aspect of this. That's still impossible. That's still incredibly hard.
Well, look at Tennessee. They had Josiah Jordan James. He withdraws from the draft. He's coming back. He's going to be their 14th guy. Like, they already have 13 scholarship players going to Tennessee. And, like, the word on the street is that man's walking on to go back. Think about that. Like, he's getting NIL deals, though. So, like, can he recoup or exceed the amount of an athletic scholarship through NIL? Like, that's
why. Well, didn't you pay for an education there? So maybe you could shed some light there, right?
Oh, well, I get emails all the time asking me to help out, but yeah, that would be a conflict of interest.
And speaking of which, though, the Vol Collective, I talked about this last week, they're doing a hell of a job. They really are doing a hell of a job. Like, I saw last week for football, you had Joe Milton and Keaton, you had them down at Times Square. The Vol Collective has raised like $7.5 million. They're aiming for $25 million. They're probably sort of at the top of the game right now when it comes to at least being sort of ambitious in that realm.
Yeah, it's huge. It's going to be the thing that helps get Tennessee football back to relevancy, because in terms of fan passion, fan support, you know, that's the thing about these collectives. A lot of it is grassroots oriented. And, you know, there's no bigger draw in the state than the Tennessee football. I mean, obviously, you know, you get your hyper-local passions for Memphis and the Nashville sports. But by and large, like, Tennessee football is the biggest sports attraction still in the state. And the huge alumni base. And that you know, Neyland Stadium seats 100,000 fans, and they fill it up oftentimes even when they're bad. And and so for them to be able to organize even off of the heels of some bad seasons and get that collective rolling, it's huge. It's huge for Tennessee, and I mean, it's going to be huge for Josh Heupel, because I mean, let's be honest, like, I don't know that he brings the best track record of recruiting into the SEC, but one, we've seen a system can work, and if you can go offer Nico $8 million to come and play quarterback for you, it doesn't matter if you're great in the living room or whatever. Like, it's that the money talks. And it's why it's like people bring up Dan Mullen getting back into coaching, and it's why I think he should. He didn't really like recruiting. It wasn't like his passion. He was more of an X's and O's guy. But like, Dan Mullen can coach, and now the money can recruit for him. So like, I would love to see a guy like that back in the game at this point, because I think it could kind of alleviate the one weakness that he had.
If someone else is paying for the talent for him, he doesn't have to worry about that part of it, really. He just he points at who he wants, and they fork up the bag.
Exactly. So there's sort of a more transactional sort of side to it now. And if you got a good scheme and you've got the bag that you can offer, like, you know, it doesn't matter if you're on the grind taking the private helicopter to a high school game every Friday night 300 miles away, right? Like, maybe you don't have to do that anymore if you're the head coach. So interesting times.
Now, SEC spring meetings, let's go right into that. Is Eli Drinkwitz the biggest loser from SEC spring meetings, talking about guys on his team getting NIL, saying they make more than my brother-in-law, who's a pediatrician who saves lives? Then he tried to back it up and talk about it and help out his image with Paul Feinbaum. Then he dropped a fake stat. He said 78% of NBA and NFL athletes go broke in 5 years after they get their money. And the biggest loser by far from SEC spring meetings.
That's wild. I missed him saying that, but I've never seen that, and I'm fairly certain that is false.
Right.
Drinkwitz was already kind of a loser. Like, he's just a dork. I mean, just being honest, like he is. Like, and I think he almost, like, leans into that and embraces it. And, like, it's almost like a bit for him. Like, he knows he's the youth pastor who somehow ended up as a college football coach. And, like, he kind of embraces, like, the shtick a little bit.
Yeah.
But you got to remember, man, you're in the SEC, and everything you say gets blown up to the nth degree. So when you say something even semi-controversial – it ends up plastered all over Twitter within 20 minutes. And the entire internet is run with it. So, like, you got to have a little more self-awareness, man.
Yeah.
You just never, as a college coach, why would you ever put yourself out there in a light where you could be seen as negative toward NIL?
Aren't there some coaches that can deal with that, obviously? Like, Kirby could say something. Nick Saban could say something. But they've won national championships. They've been there, done that. They've brought in the talent. They know that that's not going anywhere.
Yeah, and I think part of it, too, is just, like, you see a quote online on Twitter. So somebody hastily puts it out. Yeah, it may have been actually what the guy said, but it lacks context. It lacks tone of voice. It was only a third of the overall point the guy was making. I'm sure you were probably taken out of context. Like, you know, at some point, you're probably taken out of context on the radio, like today, but as a player, like, I'm sure that happened to you, right? Like, I think that's a little bit of what happened to Drinkwitz here. And he doesn't get the benefit of the doubt because, like you said, he doesn't have those titles to really back up. He's not really a voice, like a leading voice in the sport, I guess. And we don't give people the benefit of the doubt when they really don't have the clout, I guess, to lay down a little bit of rhyme there.
Well, it seems like he probably needs to spend more time trying to fundraise and get more money in their collective than being on the Sneakers app or the StockX app. He's been buying up those apps. He's been trying to get all those shoes to make himself look less youth pastory.
Right. Well, I actually know like what those websites are now because I've been looking for the Jaw 1 scratch color.
Good luck.
You know, those are like $600 on those secondary websites right now.
You can afford it. Come on.
No, man. I got the
money bag Cobb.
I did get the trivia though color on like Hibbett Sports. Like it was actually
really?
A legit retailer. Yeah, they had my size. Like I ordered them like through the normal store and all that. I kind of just got lucky one morning. Like they were on there, but. Anyway, I don't know what to do with them now. Like, I'm not sure, like, are they a collector's item or, like, what even are they at this point?
Yeah, they'll start selling the shoes again here soon once the guy's out of the whole, out of this nonsense, right? I mean, I don't know if they'll be. You can wear them. You can wear them, Cobb.
I'm almost afraid to. Like, I've never had designer sneakers before. Like, actual, like, you know, I played basketball growing up, and I was never, I never had to have, like, the newest sneakers from, like, the actual player. Like, I just went to whatever rack room and got some that fit. You know,
we had Shoe Carnival was still around when I was growing up. Do you ever go into a Shoe Carnival, spin the wheel?
Yeah, absolutely.
And also for my basketball playing days, I usually had team shoes and they were like the Hyper Dunks. They don't mean anything. they're just like basic Nike basketball shoes that no one's actually gonna wear around.
In middle school, I loved the ones that had like the little shocks on the back.
Oh, hell yes. Shocks.
Yeah, because it was like, I mean, this is physics, right? Like, if it's like a springboard. Like, this is going to make me jump higher. Like, there's no doubt.
My problem was I was a chunkier kid, so I always felt like I was going to break through the shock. Not going to absorb me, and it was just going to break down. But, you know, that's another story for another day. What do you think about Nick Saban and his comments about the NFL model, moving to the NFL model? I think we're moving. I'll preface it by saying I think we're moving to employee-employer relationship, but that is not going to serve 130 FBS programs correctly.
Yeah, you're right. I cringe when I think about it, not because the athletes don't deserve the rights of employees. I mean, with everything that's asked of college athletes, it's a full-time job, as you know full well. It's just not like I cringe thinking about, the athlete's going to be treated like that's not really what bothers me about it. It's like in the long run, it's like, what does college football look like in 15 years? And you're right, because it does not serve 130 FBS teams. But what makes college athletics so special is the NCAA basketball tournament and Fairleigh Dickinson or St. Peter's having a chance to go and play with the big dogs. It's the NCAA baseball regionals this week, where a program like Indiana State is hosting power conference teams in a regional. And it's, college football, where perhaps it's less likely that you're going to get a lower tier team as a champion, but you're still going to have the occasional monumental upset of Appalachian State over Michigan. And that doesn't happen if we're splintered off and totally factioned up into the employee league and the non-employee league, because those schools aren't going to play each other. They're not going to operate in the same world anymore. And that makes me kind of sad. Not that change can't be good. Not that there's not merit to it. There is. But at some point, the fabric of everything that we love about college sports starts to break apart, and I guess that's what I'm afraid of.
And then the responsibility of 18 to 22-year-olds, you can get hired, you can get fired. Yeah, I mean, you taxable scholarship, if you will. Like, that's part of it where the responsibility part comes in. I've said this about Deion and what he's done. Coach Prime, I should say. I shouldn't say Deion. I'll get in trouble for that.
Yeah, how dare you.
Yeah, but Coach Prime over at Colorado, what he's done in flipping that roster, I have said you need to treat younger guys, 18 to 22-year-olds, with more grace. And I don't think if we move down that path expeditiously, we're treating any of these guys with grace. If they can get cut for missing field goals if they're a kicker, if they can get cut for missing a block when they're pulling around from right guard and trying to kick out a linebacker. Like, I hope that we find different ways around it where we can at least keep some semblance of – and amateurism's dead. Like, I'm not talking about that, but some semblance of what we have grown to love – And we see now.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea of somebody getting cut, because, you know, it's how everyone says, well, we need a union, we need a collective bargaining agreement like they have in the pros.
Well, you got to pay dues, too.
Well, you do, and that doesn't stop the kicker from getting cut when he goes 1-for-3 in week 4. Like, that guy gets cut, you know? So it's, I don't know what it looks like. I really don't. I think it's got to be some sort of a hybrid, some sort of a mix where the players can capitalize on all the revenue that they're generating for the universities, but there's also some sort of guarantee or protection that they're at the very least, going to be able to lock in a 4-year scholarship. So even if the guy wants to run them off the team, they can at least have the option to remain at the school and pursue their degree, right? Like, there's got to be some protections in there like that. So I don't know. I mean, we're still a long way off.
Yeah,
there. Like,
for sure.
You know, but we've definitely taken steps. Like, the player empowerment era, if you will, is in full effect. And yeah, and eventually that has some negative side effects too, with the stuff that you mentioned, where a kid in the developmental phase of life is treated more like an expendable commodity than a college kid.
Yeah. Now, I always save the best for last with David Cobb, at David W. Cobb on Twitter from CBS Sports. Realignment talk, David.
Mm-hmm.
Got to. Colorado to the Big 12. Is this happening sooner than later?
I think so, yeah. I've been banging this drum for a while now, but look at the Pac-12 media rights situation. I mean, we've been told over and over and over again over the last year that this thing is imminent, that it's going to be cutting edge, that the new commissioner out there is going to have a streaming element to it. But at the end of the day, it's gotta keep the Pac-12 at least on par with the Big 12, or else what's going to happen? You're going to see Colorado and others, I think, leave the Pac-12 and go to the Big 12. There's more competitive opportunity in the Big 12. There's more exposure. They're more serious about sports in the Big 12. And without USC and UCLA, I just don't think the Pac-12 can compete for eyeballs the way that the Big 12 can, even without Texas and Oklahoma. So, yeah, I just think that Pac-12 media rights deal is going to be lackluster. And when it is, and when those schools see the dollar figures, they're going to be looking to jump, and I think the Big 12 is going to be there with open arms.
And I do love the Rick George quote, AD for Colorado. We are proud members of the Pac-12. In a perfect world, we'd love to be in the Pac-12, but we also have to do what is right for Colorado at the end of the day, the full quote. Fantastic. You're basically you're telling us, you're telling on yourself without telling on yourself that you are not going to be in the Pac-12 for long. Also, if they do go, is that Arizona State, Utah as well? I mean, would that be good as done?
Gotta think that league totally falls apart. I mean, I really think that's in play here. Not to be overly dramatic, but the writing has been on the wall for that conference for a while. You lose your two biggest brands in the entire Los Angeles TV market. I mean, Washington and Oregon are okay. Like, they can be an attraction or a draw or hold it together. But once you start to get other members picked off, like Oregon and Washington are going to be looking to jump too. So, it's a really rocky situation right now for the Pac-12. And honestly, it's like, I don't know if anyone out there really even cares. Like, I'm going to feel bad when at the end of all this, like, Oregon State and Washington State are left on an island and they don't really have a home and end up maybe in the Mountain West or something, like, hypothetically. But I mean, I think that's a very real scenario. Like, I really think we're in the next 12 to 18 months, if not sooner, going to see a real moment of truth for the Pac-12.
And then the most important part is they get to jump into the Big 12 potentially and get to play the Pop-Tarts Bowl.
I saw that. Yeah, there was a big discussion in our Slack room yesterday. Wait, when did the Cheez-It Bowl become the Pop-Tarts Bowl? And that has led to a long conversation.
See, why is it not the Pop-Tart Bowl? Because it was Cheez-It Bowl. It wasn't Cheez-Its Bowl. In Pop-Tarts, right. They added the S. But Pop-Tart... Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, when the game is over now, do you dump a bucket full of Pop-Tarts?
It's got to be the minis. It's got to be the minis, right?
Yeah.
You remember the little mini ones in the pack? Those were pretty good.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, we've had a debate in our Slack channel about the best type of Pop-Tart ever since that announcement came out yesterday.
Where are you at?
We decided on s'mores, I think, is the go-to.
You ever have the cinnamon roll one? I know there's not like the frost on top, but the cinnamon roll is pretty fantastic.
Yeah, solid. I grew up on the strawberry frosted as well.
I grew up on the brown sugar cinnamon ones, but I just not anymore. And also, here's the better debate, and then I'll let you go. Toasted or just uncooked?
Gabe, I figured you would cook yours in the Easy Bake Oven.
I don't know if they would get hot enough. Shout out grandfather though. Shout out to pops there. But no, what do you think though? Do you have any take on that?
I often, almost always, ate my Pop-Tarts untoasted growing up.
Yeah, and that's also because I was always a late riser, so I just grabbed the pack and got the hell out of the house.
Absolutely, absolutely. Great snack for the car.
Yes, no question. David, appreciate it, man. We'll do it again soon.
All right, man. Appreciate it.
Have a good one. That's David Cobb at David W. Cobb on Twitter, CBS Sports, college football, college basketball. Connor Dunning, you get the question now. Pop-Tart, best Pop-Tart.
Best Pop-Tart?
Best Pop-Tart. Let's hear it.
Oh, God.
Strawberry. Wildberry is pretty good.
I guess I would probably say Wildberry is my favorite.
S'mores? He said s'mores. Cobb said s'mores. I mean, it's okay.
It's all right.
A little overrated. Cinnamon roll was great.
The cinnamon one, very good. Strawberry is very good. Blueberry is very good. But I guess Wildberry is my favorite. To be honest, I haven't had a Pop-Tart in a very long time.
I mean, me either. But it's nostalgia. It's nostalgia. You still remember what they taste like, I'm sure.
Yes.
I'm sure of it.
I forgot.
It's been so long.
The sweet nectar of the Pop-Tart.
It's been so long. Now, Nuggets Heat, game one of the NBA Finals on the way tonight. Most people, including me, have picked the Nuggets. I picked the Nuggets in six. Connor has picked the Nuggets as well. You hear it everywhere that the Nuggets have been consistent throughout these playoffs, and they're going to get through the Heat relatively easily, but I'll tell you why you should hold out some hope. You should hold out some hope for the Miami Heat being able to make this thing interesting. I'll do that when I come back. 92.9 FM, ESPN.
Guests appear on the Smile Center Hotline. Now back to the Gabe Kuhn Show, live from the Service Master by Cornerstone Studios on 92.9 FM, ESPN.
Back in on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM, ESPN. Connor Dunning, are you a Chipotle fan?
So, I haven't had it in like...
Free salmonella.
Almost 10 years. They had one when I went to the University...
So, before the salmonella scare.
Yeah, when I went to the University of Tennessee, there was one on the strip right behind the dorm. Since then, though, I have not had it. It's just, for me, I'm a Booyah's guy. I'll go out to Corridor and I'll rock with some Booyah's, dude. Holy crap.
Booyah's is crack.
Oh, my God.
Booyah's is so
good. It's unbelievable. And I also have, I've lost D literally next door.
And I think, that too. And that Booyah's, the queso. Oh, God.
I'm going to be honest. I never really understood the Chipotle, the hype.
Yeah, well, I like it. I'm a fan. You know, I guess, you know, get a bowl, a little more healthy choice, still good flavor.
I like some Swankies, underrated.
I see. I haven't been to Swankies. Swankies
slaps.
Since college.
Underrated.
But did you hear about their promotion? Every time a three is made in the NBA Finals, they'll put out a keyword on their Twitter account. And if you text 888-222, their short code, you are... If you're the first 300 that texts in their keyword, you can get a free burrito or free entree. So you might have to try this out and try Chipotle back out.
That's
not bad. It's not bad.
You want to know what I thought of first when you just read that?
What?
Pray for that social media manager. Every single three that's hit?
Yeah. Yep.
That's
up
gonna
to
be
up to 35.
Oh, okay.
So once
up
it gets
35,
but that's still a lot.
Dude, that's a lot.
That's a lot of free burritos and free entrees.
At least the Celtics aren't playing anymore.
Well, they were missing them.
No, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, the Heat actually
Well,
might
but
make
they
them.
Put
the
up
Nuggets
a lot.
Might.
I mean, well, you realize, I mean, I think the Heat have been shooting 39% from three, the Nuggets 38% from three in the playoffs.
That's a lot of tweets.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot. So, for you Chipotle fans, I just gave you a hack.
Is it per game or for the series?
It's the whole series, every game.
Every game.
Every game.
Oh, my God. Pray
up
for that
to
person.
35 threes. They will give out 300 free entrees for every three made. If we could do the math on that, that would be unbelievable.
Dude, no.
Yeah, okay. you were told there would be no math.
Yeah, I was told there would be no math.
Now, Heat versus Nuggets, game one tonight. Nuggets 9-point favorites. And most people are picking the Nuggets. It makes a lot of sense. They're a bigger team. You have the best player in the world right now. Arguably, with Nikola Jokic out there, Jamal Murray's been fantastic, and they've rolled through the playoffs unscathed in a lot of ways, have not lost a game at home. They look like the more complete team right now. And the Heat, it feels like they're running on fumes, although they have ran on fumes relatively well. But Jimmy Butler said something that I really want to play here. He was in an interview with Malika Andrews, and he was asked, for people that saw it, why he did not grab his Eastern Conference Finals MVP trophy. And I think it sheds light on why the Heat are in the position they're in right now.
Conference Finals. You're at center court. Bam Adebayo takes the trophy, and he offers it to you. And you say, I'll take the next one. Walk me through that.
That's how I view it. We don't play to, and it wasn't disrespectful because I love Bam, and I'm very grateful to be able to win the Eastern Conference. But I've done that before. I have. I want to win an NBA championship. That's the reason why they put this squad together. I don't play for the Eastern Conference Finals MVP. I won't play for the Finals MVP. Could care less. I play for Mr. O'Brien.
So when did you decide? Was it in the moment or was it the day before? I'm not touching that.
Every time I play basketball, it's the end goal, the end result that I want it to be is the championship trophy. That's it. You can take all-stars, don't want to be a part of that anyways. You can take the all-NBA, could care less. All-defense team, don't care. I really only want to win a championship.
Now, I know I'm risking sounding very corny here. Very corny. But this is a perfect illustration of why the Heat are here. Like, we'll talk ball throughout this series, what the Heat can do on the floor to make it happen. What do they do in defending Nikola Jokic? Do you blitz him? Do you run a zone? Like, what are the different plans of attack? How do they win ball games? But the Heat winning this series, if they're going to win this series, is more about their edge than any quantifiable metric. I can't look on paper and in good faith pick the Miami Heat to win this series. But they've made it happen regardless of their shortcomings. You have seven undrafted free agents getting real run in the NBA playoffs. Jimmy Butler, who has been on the star, superstar edge for years. He's been cast away by three teams in his career. This is his fourth one. He's finally found a place to land. It's a tiny team with no one playing meaningful minutes over 6'9", and that's being Bam Adebayo. It's a team who is the first team in the play-in to make it to the finals, the second 8 seed ever to make it to the finals. And on the other side, you have the best current player, arguably, in the NBA in Nikola Jokic, a point guard in Jamal Murray, who's coming off a Western Conference Finals where he scored 32 points per game on 60% from the field, 50% from three, 90% from free throw line. Those were his shooting splits. And it's a team that has been undefeated at home because they've ran through the playoffs so easily, swept the Lakers. They're on rest now. I cannot look at the quantifiable metrics and tell you the Heat are going to win this series. But sometimes you look on paper and you don't see a way forward. But this is why the games are played. Let's see it. My pick continues to be Nuggets in six. And why would it be anything else? In this business where me and Connor sit, you try to use knowledge, sense, and understanding. That's how you make your picks. That's how you make predictions on what's going to happen in any given sporting event. But the Heat competing and ultimately winning this series would defy that knowledge, would defy that understanding, would defy that sense. But when they beat the Bucks, I felt the same. When they beat the Celtics, I felt the same. So this series, I hope it's interesting. And if it is interesting, it's because the Heat have willed their way to make it interesting by playing with edge, by playing with the intensity we've seen this entire time.
Guests appear on the Smile Center Hotline. Now back to the Gabe Kuhn Show, live from the Service Master by Cornerstone Studios on 92.9 FM ESPN.
Got some Godfather music coming back. And you know, we have a certain character from The Godfather that we have to talk about today. He became a father. Let's get to small talk.
Here on 92.9, we talk ball every weekday from 4 till 7 p.m. Except right now, it's time for Big Man Small Talk on 92.9's Gabe Kuhn Show.
Now, that was miserable. That was absolutely miserable.
Honestly, it wasn't bad.
It did all right, right? I just tried to, you try to talk low, a little bit Italian accent.
It's not bad.
It was bad. You don't have to help me out. I mean, you don't have to tell me I did a good job, but Santino. Al Pacino. 82 years young, Connor.
Wait.
He did a great job. He's having another kid.
Dude, you only have half the story. Do you know who else is having a kid?
Yeah, I talked about this a few weeks. De Niro. 78 years young. This is more impressive. 82. You got 4 years.
More impressive?
This is more impressive.
A
Come
couple,
on.
It's like two more pills.
You think he took more? You think he has to double the dosage?
If I had to guess, he has a For Him subscription.
No, Roman.
Roman.
He's going to Roman.
Yeah.
He's going to Roman. But Al Pacino, 82 years young, is having another kid. Now, here's where it really gets funny. Nora Alfalfa is who his girlfriend is. She's 8 months pregnant. She's 29 years old. She has previous relationships with have you heard these?
No.
Mick Jagger.
Hell yeah.
She's 29 years old. Mick Jagger, this is previous to that. She was like early 20s when she was with Mick. 61-year-old French billionaire Nicolas Berggruen, who I believe just has Berggruen Investments or whatever, and he's like a private investment guy. But he found Nora Alfalfa, and she's 8 months pregnant now. And I did the math on this, and this is the most mind-blowing stat ever. The kid would turn 18 at the same time Al turns 100 if he's so lucky to get to 100. Kid would turn 18 and have an 100-year-old father.
That's nuts. I do want to say, it sounds like that she keeps, you know, I don't want to judge this woman, but I'm just going to say, it seems like she's like, they just won't die, and I have to go, and she just keeps jumping, trying to find the one that's going to, you know.
Are you saying Kanye had a song about this? Is that what you're saying?
Maybe.
Kanye did have a song about this.
Maybe.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
I mean, she's getting some older ones. How old's Mick, by the way,
all power
at this point?
To her. A billion years old.
Let's check this out. Mick Jagger. Mick Jagger age. Mick is 79. So she clearly gets him young.
Do you think he has eligibility left?
I don't know. Oh, gosh. See, look at you.
I didn't say
you're trying to get us in trouble now.
No,
come
no.
on. I know where the... Come on. You're trying to get us in trouble, Connor.
No.
But Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, I don't know what it is, man.
Their kids should get together. Baby Pacino. Baby De Niro in Baby Heat. The action is the juice, literally.
That would be great. That would be great. We don't know if they're male or female, though.
That could complicate
the roles, though, right?
I guess so. I mean, you could slide a female into either of those roles.
Imagine, though, I mean, 18 and your dad would be 100. I don't know if dad would instill a whole lot of knowledge on you.
Don't think so.
That would be kind of tough. I'm impressed, though.
I'm very impressed.
I mean, we're talking, I know men can reproduce for longer than women. Like, I understand that. But 82 and 78, De Niro 78, Al Pacino 82. Like, I thought at some point you get stagnant. You know what I mean? I thought at some point you run out of juice.
They run out of juice.
Yeah.
The action's no longer the juice. I mean, I'm just going to say, we heard about, you know, the nursing homes, what happens there. So it's a party.
All right. On that note, Jason Munns is next. Let's go ahead and talk about DeAndre Williams and some Tiger basketball right here on 92.9 FM ESPN.